This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York. Israeli troops intensify their assault on Palestinian territories with heavy shelling of Ramallah and Bethlehem. We'll get the latest updates from the region, as well as hear from Israeli soldiers who are refusing to fight in the Palestinian-occupied territories. High U.S. import tariffs on Canadian softwood are ending the public ownership of forests in Canada. And as marriage is heavily promoted by the Bush administration as the way out of poverty, we'll hear from women who receive welfare in Seattle. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In the latest burst of Israeli military aggression, soldiers fired mortar shells into southern Lebanon today. Lebanese security and UN peacekeepers in the area said they did not know the Israelis were to make the attack, part of their ongoing campaign in the northern territory to discourage Hezbollah guerrillas from invading northern Israel. According to reports from officials in Italy, Israeli officials have told them and a number of other European countries that Lebanon and Syria have been warned. They want Hezbollah guerrillas now massing at the northern border zone to pull out immediately or face a serious response. Lebanese Hezbollah guerrillas attacked the Israeli outposts in the zone earlier today. As Ellen Ratner reports, the Israeli government says they are defending themselves and in the process of fighting global terrorism.
As the Israeli siege of Ramallah and the West Bank continues, Israel is insisting that it is acting only in self-defense. In addition, they are saying that no civilian Palestinians have been killed. On a radio talk show this morning, Israeli embassy spokesperson Mark Regev defended the way that the military has been carrying out this action.
I think if you look at what the Israeli army is doing today, I haven't seen a single civilian casualty, and I hope that stays true. No, if you look, they've all been combatants. I mean, if there would have been a civilian casualty and see the name all over the news, you haven't seen one. We make a maximum effort to avoid collateral damage.
Allegra Pashko, an American human rights lawyer who is in Palestinian-controlled areas, had a different view.
The Israelis somehow put out a rumor that the curfew was lifted. Some people went out and a boy was shot and a woman was shot on the street. So it's really a very, very dangerous place.
The White House maintains Israel's right to defend itself. Spokesperson Ari Fleischer reiterated Secretary of State Colin Powell's assertion that the United States should deal with Arafat as head of the Palestinian Authority from his current location in Ramallah. For Free Speech Radio News at the White House, I'm Ellen Ratner.
At today's United Nations Chinese Foreign Ministry meeting on international disarmament, China's foreign minister declared unilateralism the major force behind weapons proliferation. While he did not specifically name the United States, analysts believe it was a direct comment about the U.S. military action in Afghanistan, unilaterally resigning from the anti-ballistic missile treaty, and development of a so-called missile defense shield. The U.S. representative to the conference says the Bush administration is fully committed to multilateral arms control institutions. U.S. government figures indicate that fewer people lost their jobs in March than in the months prior. But a new report shows that African-American men are still having a hard time finding employment. Gareth Schweitzer has more from D.C.
The Brookings Institution's Center on Urban and Metropolitan Policy looked at statistics from the past 21 years and found that only half of African-American males between the ages of 16 and 24 were employed. This represents a significant decline in employment rates for this group of men. Paul Offner, one of the authors of the study, argues that the increase in female employment and corresponding decline of employment for males in the African-American community can be explained by welfare's focus on women.
What's happened, particularly over the last 10 years, is that the employment of young African-American women has increased very substantially. The men who are the fathers of their children, their employment has been declining. We need to worry about that problem.
The study also shows that white and Hispanic men with a similar educational background have not seen a decline in employment levels, while employment of African-American women has increased substantially. In Washington, D.C., for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
And finally, with a mere 3,000 left, the endangered Florida manatee is now being threatened by a parasite found in human feces. Sally Watt reports from St. Petersburg.
last week when a manatee beached itself on the shores of Tampa Bay and died 2 days later, University of South Florida microbiologist Mylian Dow discovered that the animal was infected with a parasite that spread through polluted water. She says she found the same parasite in 10 other manatees that died within the last year. The parasite is called Microsporidia. It's present in the waste of infected humans. The USF scientist speculates that manatees have been swimming in water polluted with the sewage and that the infection invades the manatees through wounds from being hit by boat propellers. Other experts expressed caution about the finding, saying that it's possible that many manatees do carry the parasites but show no ill effects from them. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sally Watt in St. Petersburg.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
As news comes in from the West Bank, we're hearing that an estimated 400 Palestinians trapped in the West Bank compound have surrendered to Israeli troops after a night of heavy shelling by the Israeli military. For the latest update, we go to Palestinian doctor and president of the Palestinian Medical Relief, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti.
This morning we had from 1 o'clock in the morning till 6 a.m., we had the most terrifying attack using Apache helicopters, tanks, bombarding several parts of the city. And today the curfew is there for the fifth day. The Israeli army claimed that there will be a lifting of the curfew for 4 hours, but what happened actually is that people started to get out for an hour, and then the army started shooting at them, and they injured a young boy, 14 years old, who was walking in the street thinking that there is no curfew. So practically, there was no lifting of the curfew. The whole city is under complete curfew. The Israelis committed today another crime by arresting medical teams who were trying to provide assistance to the injured. Nine first aid providers and doctors and ambulance drivers were arrested, handcuffed, and kept in the rain with their hands cuffed for 7 hours. And then they were taken to a detention center where they were kept till the evening. And three of them are now in the hospital because of the severe conditions that they had. More than that, the Israeli army is now invading another city, Jenin. 200 tanks are attacking the city from various locations. Sharon is expanding the occupation. He's aggravating the problem. And today in Ramallah, the hospital could not keep any more 65 bodies that it had in its in the hospital. They had to be buried, and since the Israeli army did not even allow the hospital to bury these people in the cemetery, the hospital organized their burial gather in one collective grave in the yard of the hospital.
Israel's calling this their Operation Protective Wall, where they're saying they want to uproot the militants that they blame for these string of attacks on Israelis, and they're saying that that's who they're going after. Have they managed to root out or catch any of these supposed militants?
I think the aim is not to catch militants. The aim is to catch the West Bank completely and to destroy any potential for peace. This has always been the aim of Sharon. Sharon did not agree with Oslo, did not agree with the creation of a Palestinian entity, and what he is doing now is a process of destruction of the infrastructure of the Palestinian, the independent infrastructure of Palestine.
And just finally, if you can tell us, the latest that we've heard here is that Prime Minister Sharon has offered Arafat an envoy into exile. What is the latest that you've heard down there? What is Arafat's situation?
Arafat belongs to his country. He's a Palestinian. Sharon came from another country, and he is the one who should be offered exile if that is the case. Sharon has no right whatsoever to offer such a humiliating offer to neither Mr. Arafat nor any other Palestinian. I know that Sharon wants to exile all of us because that's what he has. It's the idea of transfer, and I think nobody, Arafat is ready to die without accepting that. And I believe the issue here is not only about Arafat. The issue here is about the Palestinian people who is suffering so much, who's been suffering for 35 years of occupation, and who has decided that it cannot continue to live under this oppression. Time has come for these people to be free. time has come for us to be free from occupation. And not the Israeli tanks, nor the helicopters, nor anything else can break the will of the people who are determined to be free from oppression, to have justice, and to have freedom.
Mustafa Barghouti, President of the Palestinian Medical Relief, thank you for joining us on Free Speech Radio News, and we'll continue to follow the latest developments as they happen.
In Bethlehem, Israeli military aggression has also escalated. Gunship helicopters have been hovering overhead where they've fired on the Church of the Nativity, where tradition says Jesus was born. International peace observer and Free Speech Radio News correspondent Kristen Scher has the latest from Bethlehem.
I'm reporting by candlelight on a rainy night from Al Azza Beit Jabir refugee camp inside Bethlehem under siege. At 1 a.m. this morning, the Israeli government declared Bethlehem a closed military zone. All Americans were offered evacuation by the U.S. consulate, but many have refused to abandon the Palestinians to certain death at the hands of Israeli military. 7 Americans have issued a statement demanding full Israeli military withdrawal and respect for U.N. resolutions 242 and 348. Within the past 2 hours, 5 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers who have taken over Manger Square, where a massacre is expected. A priest and 4 nuns have been shot by Israeli soldiers in the Church of the Nativity. It is impossible to get into Manger Square to get out victims of shootings. A mother and a son were shot early this morning, and their bodies have yet to be taken away from the house where other children are currently living. 150 members of the Palestinian resistance are fighting Israeli tanks and soldiers in the square. The University of Bethlehem is being shelled, as is the area next to Beit Jala Hospital. 6 tanks are surrounding the Bethlehem Star Hotel, where several internationals are staying. Tanks are heavily shelling Al-Aida refugee camp and have surrounded Al-Azza refugee camp as well. U.S.-made APCs, armed personnel carriers, carried 150 Israeli soldiers around the camp. 2 tanks and a bulldozer made by U.S. Corporation Caterpillar passed by a previously demolished house and trees. Israeli soldiers shot rounds at the 3rd floor of the building before stopping to casually smoke cigarettes in the open. They seem to perceive no threat from the Palestinian people here in Al-Azza Beit Jabir refugee camp. Israeli snipers have been shooting directly into the camp from the Paradise Hotel, and Apache helicopters flew overhead throughout the night, 2 every 10 minutes. Many Palestinian families stayed up throughout the night waiting. F-16s shot from the night sky as well. The families sit and wait indoors for the inevitable Israeli roundup and arrest of all Palestinian men inside the camp. Yesterday's Palestinian suicide bomber came from Bethlehem. The news was delivered with a despairing, "They're dying anyway." This afternoon in Beit Jala, a mother and her 4 children were murdered by Israeli soldiers. The IDF told the BBC that it would allow reporters into Bethlehem, but not out. And in Ramallah this morning, 2 U.S.-made and donated Apache helicopters fired at a building, massacring 20. The U.S.-backed Israeli occupation is at a critical point. Many Palestinians ask for the right of return and a Palestinian state and are frightened and trying to survive under siege amid the constant din of Israeli fire. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Kristen Scher in Al-Azza Beit Jabir refugee camp, Bethlehem, Palestine.
Thousands of peace activists rallied outside a Jerusalem prison where 2 dozen Israeli soldiers are being held. Since the start of the Intifada, more than 65 Israeli soldiers have been sentenced to jail time for refusing to serve in the Palestinian-occupied territories. They are the refuseniks. Correspondent Peretz Kidron helped organize the action.
Today we held a freedom seder opposite the military prison where some of these refuseniks are held. And in the course of the seder, which lasted about 2 hours, in the course of the seder, we got reports of 3 additional refuseniks that have been sentenced. At this time, there are 20 refuseniks in various prisons. 65 have done jail time for refusal since the beginning of the Intifada. But the significant number is that, according to our records, well over 500 have refused. 500, majority, of course, reservists. 500 Israeli IDF soldiers have refused to take part in a campaign of repression in the occupied territories.
That's Peretz Kidron in Jerusalem. Israeli refuseniks are also touring the United States, speaking to largely Jewish crowds to share their first-hand experiences as part of the occupying army. Correspondent Aaron Glantz caught up with one of them in Berkeley. He files this report.
The goal of our group, first of all, and very simply, is to delegitimize the occupation.
Israeli military reservist Tamir Sorek won't serve in the West Bank and Gaza. He told the crowd at Berkeley's Unitarian Fellowship Hall he decided he couldn't take part in the occupation when he worked for an international NGO in the West Bank that helped certify Yasser Arafat's election in 1996.
When I saw these people from very close point are trying to build a civil society, I knew that I cannot be there anymore as an occupier, even though I have an elected government that decided that I should be there.
Even when the Israeli army isn't launching a major offensive, Sorek says, the reality of Palestinian life under occupation is often brutal. He cites house-to-house searches as one example.
Their mission was to prevent the next attack in the Israeli city, in Tel Aviv, in Haifa, to save life of Israeli children. And their order was to get into the houses and look for explosives. And what they do if they cannot go into one of the houses, if the door is locked? Maybe in this particular house, the explosive is there. You have to look everywhere. So the soldiers put explosives near the door in order to explode the door and get in.
Sorek explains the result at one Palestinian home.
Someone called from outside in Arabic and called the people to be careful and go far from the place. But people, when an occupied people are in their house and they hear the army of the enemy shouting from outside, they are scared. They are not... maybe they didn't hear. You have many reasons for people for not going outside. And after the door was exploded, they get in. They found a woman very seriously injured. And since in another places the ambulances were not allowed to get in, the woman died in front of her children.
This week, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon called up 30,000 additional reservists to fight his war against the Palestinian Authority and its president, Yasser Arafat. Every day, scores of Palestinians are killed and injured, and every day brings a new suicide bomb blast in Israel. Sorek calls on more soldiers to refuse to fight.
The Israelis and Palestinians are going to destroy each other, and it is really, really urgent to prevent them. The way to prevent them is to support us, because we have to say to Sharon, you don't have soldiers for this war.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Berkeley.
Last Friday, the U.S. Department of Commerce made its final decision to add an import duty of an average of 29% on most Canadian softwood lumber entering the country. This tariff replaces the 1996 softwood lumber agreement between the U.S. and Canada that expired a year ago. Within the last year, about 15,000 mill workers lost their jobs, and 15,000 more losses are expected. Remote resource-dependent communities are already disappearing throughout British Columbia. Global forest industry market conditions are actually hurting both U.S. and Canadian industries. The U.S. tariffs are an attempt to end public ownership of forest lands in Canada. Thatcher Collins reports from British Columbia.
Last March, the U.S. forest industry formed the Coalition for Fair Lumber Imports to bring a tariff to Canadian softwood lumber in provinces with publicly held timberland. They say the provincial governments unfairly subsidize the lumber industry, who then dump lumber onto the U.S. The result of the tariff is over 30,000 lost jobs in British Columbia. Norman Rivard of the Industrial Wood and Allied Workers of Canada talked to the Canadian negotiators.
We tell them, first of all, not to agree to any type of countervailing duties, because there is a NAFTA agreement, there's a free trade agreement. Either we have free trade or we don't.
Both the BC government and the Canadian federal government have slashed their forest regulatory departments. Kamloops forest regulator Frank Anderson says that these budget cuts, office closures, and tariffs fuel black market cutting of trees in BC. The black market and other forms of cheating the system are already a major portion of the forest economy. Will Horter is the director of Victoria-based Forest Futures.
The area in the mid-coast, which many people refer to as the Great Bear Rainforest, the woods coming out of there, the companies are losing $9 to $11 a cubic meter, and the only reason they're logging is because they're being subsidized. That's not being reported.
Taking the softwood case to the World Trade Organization or the North American Free Trade Agreement would take years, and in the meantime, some BC forest companies would go out of business and open up opportunities for buyouts from big Canadian companies or U.S.-based multinationals. Will Horter explains what the media is not reporting about going to the WTO.
The other thing is all these claims about that Canada's going to win at the WTO, and they've won at all these international tribunals before. What they don't report is that, yeah, Canada's won a few of these, but most of the time when they've won when the panel has had two Canadians and one American, and they've lost when it's had, you know, a different makeup. And nobody's looked at the merits of the Canadian claim before the WTO, which frankly I think are ridiculous. I mean, they have virtually no chance of winning. They're making technical legal arguments. They're not saying, oh, we're not subsidized.
Alternatives promoted by Horter and municipal leaders, like bringing land tenure agreements to many smaller companies, have received no consideration by Canadian negotiators or the media. U.S. media coverage of the trade dispute is sparse. Norman Rivard responds to claims of U.S. layoffs.
We are sending enough raw logs in the Pacific Northwest to operate three large sawmills that created employment. These sawmills don't have enough saw logs to operate their mills. And ironically enough, there is no duties put on those raw logs.
Raw log export bans require at least one value-added stage to happen at home and therefore retain jobs and revenue. Any Canadian politician that considers the U.S. demand for lifting that ban wouldn't be a politician for much longer. The trade dispute even has some Canadian parliamentarians talking about blocking the free trade area of the Americas as a form of retaliation. Thatcher Collins, Free Speech Radio News, British Columbia.
As the nation's attention remains squarely on the war against terrorism, one of the many issues facing the home front that will more likely than not be swished past the public's notice is the upcoming reauthorization of welfare reform legislation. While welfare rolls around the country have declined, allowing states to claim welfare reform is a success, the reality is that poverty has not declined and in many states has in fact risen. And as the Bush administration prepares its final policies for the fast-approaching TANF reauthorization, the administration has defined the promotion of a healthy marriage as an essential, unfinished piece of the welfare reforms that the federal government set in motion in the mid-1990s. Martha Baskin takes a look at the effect of welfare reform on women in Seattle.
Many stories of women in welfare are ones of domestic violence, alcohol abuse, dire poverty, and choosing between food and shelter. Less often do they become tales of triumph and success.
1995, I left my children's father and my husband because of domestic violence.
Cindy Hutchings.
The final deciding factor was one day when he had turned his anger on my children, on my son. And then I could see that I had to go, and I started planning, and within a week I had moved out.
Sylvia Sabone and the father of her children were ultimately jailed for fighting under the influence.
Then they said, you need to straighten up, or are you going to get your kids taken away? I said, I'd rather straighten up and get the guy out of my house before my kids get taken away.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did.
Sylvia Sabone and Cindy Hutchings have come a long way since those days. Sylvia has been sober since 1997 and held the same job since 1998. Cindy graduates from the University of Washington this spring with a bachelor's in women's studies and English. She's been on the dean's list every quarter. Both are actively working to defeat Bush's welfare reform plan. Sylvia is a board member of the Welfare Rights Organizing Coalition in Seattle, and Cindy, a student intern there. Sylvia works 40 hours a week at a mortgage company and takes computer classes two nights a week to upgrade her job skills. The state of Washington subsidizes her two daughters' child care with federal funds from TANF, or Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, currently up for reauthorization. The child subsidy is a choice left to the state. But Bush's plan put Sylvia in an impossible predicament. No monies have been allocated for child care funding, Again, Sylvia Sabone.
We don't want to go back to square one, back on welfare. But if you take our child care away, that's what's going to happen. I mean, there's no way we're not going to pay $600 for each kid if you're only making $2,000. And some people make less than I do.
The Bush welfare plan discounts the nationwide recession and the fact that the industry's hardest hit by recession are those employing large numbers of low-wage workers. Existing education and training programs will be rolled back. Anyone receiving any type of welfare will be forced out of education and into workfare programs that pay below the minimum wage. The largest workfare program in New York has displaced unionized workers and resulted in few real long-term jobs for participants. Cindy chose to attend college full-time when she was able to receive financial aid from the university. With child support from her ex, enforced by the state, augmented by state medical and food assistance for low-income families, she's been able to support her family. She plans to become a domestic violence counselor and hopefully earn a living wage.
And yet, the president has offered a plan that demands that more of the women on welfare go to work and demands that they spend more hours every week at work and provides no additional money for child care and no additional money for paid community jobs.
Nancy Amedee, senior lecturer in social work at the University of Washington.
So when you add all those different pieces together, what you find is that women are going to be forced into unpaid workfare. The only alternative they would have is that they would lose their TANF grants, and that means their children wouldn't eat and wouldn't be housed.
Although caseloads have been reduced by over 40% since 1997, the first year TANF was enacted, only 45% of clients in Washington State's welfare program, Work First, have earned enough money to lift their families out of poverty. Those who have left welfare are earning a median wage rate of between $7 and $7.50 an hour, or between $10,000 and $12,000 a year. 30,000 of the state's home care workers, which the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, is in the process of organizing, are in such dire straits that they must choose between food and rent. 65% to 70% of them are women. Many have lost welfare due to the 5-year lifetime cap, which does not take into account the ages of a family's children. Liz Goodwin is an organizer with SEIU Local 6.
Well, it's real challenging for the women in particular who are taking care of their children on their own and working two jobs and then are asked by us to get involved. So we really have to put them to a challenge, which is that this is an investment in their future and they need to make some sacrifices right now in order to get better wages, get medical, full medical, get a pension, and have a better life in the future.
It may be asking a lot, but with support from unions, welfare rights coalitions, Washington's Working Families Campaign, and the statewide Poverty Action Network, to name but a few, less women may someday soon have to make such choices. For now, Sylvia and Cindy and the thousands who joined them will not rest until reducing child and family poverty becomes the benchmark for welfare reform instead of reducing the welfare rolls and creating more low-wage jobs. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York City, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. I'm Deepa Fernandez.